It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we mark the 50-year anniversary of the science fiction film 2001: A Space Odyssey. We'll learn about the collaboration between director Stanley Kubrick and science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke and the difficulties on the set while making a film of that scale. First, major changes are underway at the Milwaukee County Jail after a federal report uncovered numerous issues at the facility. That report was publicly released yesterday, and the acting sheriff says a lot of the recommended changes have already been made. The report also comes in light of several deaths at the facility, including an inmate who died of dehydration there in April of 2016. Chuck Krumbach was there yesterday at the facility for the public release of the report. He joins us now. Chuck is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And Chuck, can you talk a little bit about what prompted this report to be conducted in the first place?
Well, as you said, there were the jail deaths in 2016 and 2017. Most occurred under the former sheriff, David Clarke, acting sheriff Richard Schmidt, when he moved up from deputy to acting sheriff when David Clarke left in late August of 2017. Acting Sheriff Schmidt said, well, listen, we're going to have an outside group, the National Institute for Corrections, take a look at jail policies. I don't want any more deaths. I don't want any more controversies. And so that's how that report came about. The investigators came in late February of this year, and Sheriff Clarke, or Acting Sheriff Schmidt, I should say, handed out the report yesterday.
What were some of the main recommendations in that report?
Well, there were 17, 15 of which Acting Sheriff Schmidt says he's already addressed, things like making lockdowns of inmates not as frequent, improving suicide watch logs, improvements in medical screenings, and improving the inmate grievance procedure. There's a couple things that Acting Sheriff Schmidt says have not been fully implemented yet. A staffing analysis that an outside firm will do, and also sort of a general review of jail policies.
And talk about this tour I understand the acting sheriff gave to members of the media and some elected officials.
Right. So we started out in the entrance area where prisoners are brought in, and then saw where they are medically checked, screened by health personnel. Then we were also shown a special mental health unit for inmates that are in crisis. They're off their medications and so on. We were also taken to a discipline area, or they call them pods, where people who have gotten in fights and caused other disturbances are stationed for a while. And we also saw a more general population area, a day room, and also cells up on the sixth floor. We did not see what Sheriff Schmidt said was the nerve center that was controlling our doors and lights and so on, but we did see quite a bit of the jail.
And Chuck, I'm going to make my bid for understatement of the year. This open tour for the for the members of the media releasing this report to the public, this is a bit different in style to previous Sheriff David Clarke. Is that right?
Well, yes. Acting Sheriff Schmidt usually does not, or I haven't really heard him much criticize David Clarke at all. Schmidt was Clarke's deputy. On the other hand, Schmidt tries to make it clear that things have changed, times have changed, Sheriff Clarke is gone, Acting Sheriff Schmidt is in charge, at least for this year, and wants to be as transparent and open as possible. Did we see everything? No, we certainly didn't, but we saw more than has been the case. And the county executive, Abley, was there, and the county board chairman, Lipscomb, was there, and they both said afterwards that things are moving in the right direction. I think there may be community groups that still say there could be more done in terms of reducing access, reducing mass incarceration, but for now, there doesn't seem to be tremendous controversy about what's going on at the jail now, but there are those cases stemming from the Terrell Thomas dehydration death that you mentioned earlier.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Krumbach about changes in the works at the Milwaukee County Jail after a tour there for members of the media. On that tour, Chuck, Acting Sheriff Schmidt took visitors to the jail's special mental health unit where inmates who are in crisis are held. Here's a bit of what he had to say there.
When these individuals come in, the families want to know that those inmates are being cared for. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to state, as Sheriff of Milwaukee County, I'm seeing that they're cared for. That's why you're here today, to witness that this is taking place. It is a transparent transformation.
Transparency, was that one of his big messages on this tour?
I think that quote sort of summed up the entire hour-long tour, that, again, that things have changed. We're showing you some key areas here, and until there's something else that comes up in the way of news that shows differently, we're open and transparent. People that work in the jail and visit the jail on professional reasons have told me things are generally better, but there are some problems, as I say, those couple of recommendations that I mentioned, including staffing, and I can talk more about that.
Yeah, talk more about staffing. I understand that is something that the acting sheriff brought up.
Right. So the goal is to have 300 correctional officers at the jail. When Acting Sheriff Schmidt took over last September or late August, there were about 200. He's upped that to 270. So he's got a ways to go in terms of hiring. He's tried to bring down overtime, which is, you know, overtime has been implemented to try to make up for some of the staffing shortfall. So he's tried to bring down the overtime and add more full-time, you know, straight-time people, but he's got a ways to go. But on the other hand, as he and his jail administrator said, retention is an issue. They said they lose about a third of the correctional officers every year, so you can add more, but if you're going to lose a chunk, that makes the gain to back to full employment, so to speak, a slow climb.
What did he say about the nature of the job that makes it hard to hire people, maybe, and obviously to keep them, it sounds like?
Well, you've got inmates who have these medical needs. He said about 30% are in there on psychotropic medication. They, in other words, they're not the most stable individuals. There are others that come in with alcohol problems and so on. Many have been charged with violent crimes. And if you're in the jail, you're probably, you know, not a particularly happy person. So it's very difficult, as we've seen in other institutions around the state, where the job of a correctional officer is very difficult. And Sheriff Schmidt says the pay is not super, and that's why things are, again, are understaffed a bit, but he says things are improving. We will see.
And we've been mentioning Richard Schmidt is the acting sheriff after the departure of David Clark. What is the status of getting a new permanent sheriff in Milwaukee County?
Well, it is a political year, so we kind of asked him about that. As he is acting sheriff, he says he had no public statement to release from Governor Walker's office. The governor last fall took applications for an interim sheriff position, and Sheriff Schmidt applied. He is still the acting sheriff. The governor has not named an interim. The governor's office says the process is ongoing, but acting Sheriff Schmidt said he expected to be in place for the rest of this calendar year. He will decide within a few weeks if he's going to run for election this fall. There's a sheriff's election this fall. There's several other candidates already announced or thinking about running, so we'll find out soon if Sheriff Schmidt wants the job beyond 2018 November.
Briefly, Chuck, as we wrap up, what are you watching for going forward at the Milwaukee County Jail?
Well, there's the cases of the Terrell Thomas, the people charged with facing criminal charges in that, and also the health provider, these other things that are unresolved, staffing and so on. And because it's such a volatile situation with the inmates and the type of inmates, things can come up suddenly over there. There was a medical emergency yesterday that was quickly resolved, apparently, but those things happen quite often, I'm told, and can often turn into something worse.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about changes underway at the Milwaukee County Jail and uncertainty about the ongoing leadership there. 50 years ago this week, when director Stanley Kubrick released 2001: A Space Odyssey, a lot of critics panned the movie and many confused viewers walked out of theaters before it ended. 50 years later, the film is considered a masterpiece. It consistently ranks as one of the most influential movies of all time. Michael Benson takes us behind the scenes. He's the author of the new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, I want to take you back to 1968. 2001 comes out. A science fiction fan takes her six-year-old kid to see the movie, and that kid is you. Talk about what it was like seeing this movie as a six-year-old kid.
Yeah, my mom was an Arthur C. Clarke fan, read all his books, and when 2001 came out, she took me to see it. And I just remember being absolutely staggered, and not just staggered in the way a six-year-old is staggered about everything. I was really impressed by that film, and I think it was the first masterpiece in any genre that really spoke to me. And it was confusing, of course, and I think it was confusing to a lot of people. I think one reason that that film remains so salient, let's say, today, and so provocative today, is that it's a kind of masterpiece of ambiguity in a way. Now, I couldn't have articulated it that way at the time. I do remember following my mom down the sidewalk. It was a hot summer day. I think it was New York. And I was saying, but what did it mean? You know, and her response was, I don't know.
Yeah, the movie stuck with you. You stuck with the movie. You've got a new book out now. 50 years later, what is it about 2001 that makes it still worth talking about and watching?
Well, I mean, that film encompasses 4 million years of human evolution and, you know, seems to span most of known space. So it's pretty comprehensive. That's about as comprehensive as you can possibly get. It has multiple themes within it that are still salient today. One of them concerns artificial intelligence with HAL, the HAL 9000 computer. And by the way, I just wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times about exactly that, about HAL and current machine learning algorithms and manipulation due to AI.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Well, that's one place where 2001 remains relevant. But there are many others. I mean, you know, the larger questions concerning our destiny as a species and our place in the universe, I mean, that couldn't be, that's just kind of a perennially timely.
And you mentioned the author, Arthur C. Clarke. You talked to him for the writing of this book. I understand he had set out to make the first really good science fiction movie. Talk about what he was hoping to get out of this that hadn't been put on film in the science fiction genre.
Yeah, so I met Arthur in the year 2001, and it wasn't with the intention of writing a book about 2001. I had some other agenda, and we hit it off and became friends, and I visited him subsequently in Sri Lanka 3 more times. And it was actually Kubrick's line about doing the proverbial really good science fiction movie. And his letter written to Clarke on March 31st, 1964, proposing that they meet and discuss that possibility. What did Clarke want out of it? Clarke wanted an big international deal. He had had a number of novels out, lots of short stories, and was intrigued. He was a little jealous, I think, that Robert Heinlein had written the script for Destination Moon 10 years before. And what did he want? He wanted a great collaboration that would lead to a superb film based on his ideas, and that's what he got.
When I think of movie making, I think probably incorrectly think, okay, you go in, you've got this script, you have a roadmap, you know what you're doing, and you know what the end point looks like. That was definitely not the case for 2001. This tale evolved in the production of the movie, right?
Yeah, that's another extraordinary thing about 2001. I mean, Kubrick had a budget comparable to a James Cameron budget today or Lucas or what have you. That is not usually a situation where you want to be improvising a lot and changing the story as you're shooting. But he did just that. Kubrick and Clarke were modifying the story throughout. There was never a fixed script. It was an R&D project on multiple levels, including the storyline, but also about technologies and how to convincingly portray spacecraft on screen and portray interstellar travel on screen, you know. They were inventing it all as they went along.
We'll be right back.
that's an important point you talk about a lot in the book. You know, if you think of older science fiction movies, there's the flashy ray guns and saucer-like flying ships. They really did, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the crew did as much as they could based on the technology at the time to make this look plausible, to design stuff that might conceivably work, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I got to know Tony Fruin, who was a young assistant to Kubrick at the time, you know, during the production in 2001. He said in one of his earliest conversations with Kubrick, they had a long talk. At one point, they were discussing science fiction, and Kubrick said, cinema has let science fiction down. And what he meant was there was so much good science fiction published, you know, before 64, 65. But film had not risen to the occasion in his view. There had been as you said, all those ray gun films, Flash Gordon, low budget, you know. But Kubrick wanted to really kick it upstairs, and I think he succeeded.
And in making this technology real, they kind of had to invent stuff. And I guess there were a lot of problems with things like spacesuits with limited amounts of oxygen and centrifuges that blew up lights and things like that. Can you talk about some of the technological hazards that went into making this movie?
So the centrifuge set was 38 feet wide and many tons. And had a, you know, it was motorized to turn. It was like a hamster wheel. And film lights don't really like to go upside down, and they had hundreds of them on the thing. And, you know, when they spun it, you know, frequently bulbs would blow up and shower glass down, and it was a hazardous environment. It was a really hazardous environment. As for the spacesuits being hermetically sealed, now that's a story. Stuntman Bill Weston's heroic performance hanging above the studio floor, 30 feet above the studio floor with no net and one of those spacesuits hermetically sealed. So he did have an oxygen bottle, a very small oxygen bottle inserted in the back, you know, in the backpack of the spacesuit. But there was no way for the carbon dioxide to escape the suit. So there's a whole story that I tell in the book, you know, about Weston going to Kubrick and saying, you know, Stanley, I'd like to punch some holes in the back of the helmet so I can get some fresh air. And Kubrick refused because he was afraid there would be light leaking in those holes. And yeah, okay, so I'm not going to get into all the detail now, but the upshot is that one of the first times that Weston was hanging up there, he went unconscious from the carbon dioxide poisoning. He did that after the crew below said, we have to bring Bill in. You know, he's signaling to us he needs to come in. And he heard, Weston heard Kubrick saying, no, I didn't get the shot yet. Leave him up there. So when Weston came to, and by the way, Bill Weston had been a mercenary in South Africa. He was not somebody you wanted to mess with. Weston was furious when he came to, and he went up to find Kubrick to teach him a lesson, basically. And Kubrick had fled the studio and didn't come back for 3 days.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult.
Now, the movie comes out, you saw it and were confused but blown away by it. A lot of critics, Roger Ebert, some science fiction authors, I think Ray Bradbury, didn't like this movie. They thought in that vast scale you mentioned earlier, the human element was lost. Talk about some of the reception then and how it's changed.
So there was an initial perception that the film was cold and inhuman and that this was a mistake. Now, there were... Everything Kubrick did was intentional, basically, not to, you know. I didn't write a hagiography, and he had his fault. But the portrayal of human beings as essentially component parts of their technology was very willful and conscious. And he was saying something about our relationship to technology and how technology was also changing us. And so people didn't really get it. The older generation of critics, most of them didn't get it. So, for example, Andrew Saris wrote in The Village Voice that 2001 was a thoroughly uninteresting failure and the most damning demonstration yet of Stanley Kubrick's inability to tell a story coherently and with a consistent point of view. So these were slams. Those are very personal kind of slams. And there was a lot of that in the opening week. The film. But the younger generation lined up to see that film, and later on Kubrick said a teenager saved his film. There was no problem with younger people who were younger understanding what Kubrick was getting at, you know. The entire counterculture embraced that film. It was kind of a piece with some of the radical cultural, experimental, avant-garde innovations going on in the 60s. So they got it. The older generation didn't. And it was, you know, this is 68 we're talking. So it was really that generational divide at work.
And Michael, there's a new generation out there that may not have seen this movie. Can you make the case for those teenagers, 20-somethings today, to go out and stream or rent or however they see the movie now?
Well, by the way, Warner's is going to re-release it this year, so they should go see it on a big screen.
And
they
absolutely
should, because, you know, that film, it's extraordinary that so much of it has not dated. It's still futuristic today. You know, we don't have an AI, general intelligence, artificial general intelligence is the term used in computer science, like HAL 9000. You know, we don't have some of the technologies that you can see in the film. But that's not the reason to go see it. The reason to see it is the grand vision of our position in the universe. That's just timeless, you know. And I predict that film is going to still be discussed and analyzed and studied, you know, for hundreds of years in the future. I think it's one of those keepers from the 20th century.
It's a good place to leave it, Michael. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks. It was really a pleasure. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Benson, author of the new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. At this time next Friday, we'll talk about the music and sound used in the film to illustrate the loneliness of space travel and just how big the universe is. Whether you're a casual runner or training for something big, proper nutrition can support you in your exercise program. Knowing what to eat before and after, maybe even during, for your runs can help keep your body healthy and recover from injuries faster. Anita Bean joins us now for this week's edition of Food Friday. She's a registered nutritionist, health writer, and internationally published author, and an athlete herself. She specializes in sport and exercise nutrition. Her latest book is The Runner's Cookbook. Anita, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Thank you for having me on your show.
So what are some of the special needs that a runner might have, even a casual runner, as opposed to a non-athlete?
Well, as a runner, really, as soon as you take up running, that means that you've got to start paying a bit more attention to what you're eating, because you're not going to get any faster or fitter if you continue to eat a poorly planned diet. And definitely, it's very important that you eat enough calories, you eat a balanced, varied diet to provide your body with all the nutrients that you need to recover and perform to your full potential. So you will need more carbs, particularly if you're doing long distances and you're doing high-intensity running. But you will definitely need more vitamins, more minerals, a little bit of everything, really. And you know, if you're not getting all those things, if you're eating the wrong foods, then you will increase your risk of injury and illness, and that will prevent your body adapting to your running program.
And I think a lot of people might think, okay, great, I'm running, I'm getting exercise, I'm burning calories, so that means I just get to eat more stuff. Is that something you run across?
Yeah, definitely. You know what? That is the biggest mistake that every runner makes. They, exactly as you said, they think that because they're running, they can eat, it's a license to eat what they want. They can tuck into their donuts, they can tuck into more ice cream and big family-sized pizzas. But, you know, the truth is that if you overeat, you know, if you're misjudging your food intake, then you will get weight gain ultimately, and that will slow you down running. So, you know, you certainly won't get any fitter and faster with your running, and, you know, you'll get the opposite gains from those that you really want. So that's why it really is important that you at least pay a small amount of attention to what you're eating, because that will make a huge difference to your performance.
Is this something that's really only important for, you know, somebody who's going to go out and run a serious, you know, marathon or something? Or is this worth thinking about even for the casual starting runner who's going to just try to get a couple miles in every week?
Definitely. Whether you're a beginner, you know, you're just starting out, as you say, somebody who just enjoys keeping fit, you know, doing a few miles here and there, or if you're a serious runner, you're entering races, or even if you're a runner who's training up for a marathon, nutrition will... Basically, what it does, it will allow you to run to your full potential. So, you know, you might not be destined to win the Boston Marathon or the Chicago Marathon. It would still allow you to run to your, you know, to your best potential. and it will allow you to increase your stamina faster. It will allow you to get greater gains in your strength, basically allow you to perform better, to recover faster. And, you know, if you are running perhaps every day, you know, a lot of runners will want to run every day or at least exercise every day. That recovery period is so important, and that's really where nutrition plays such an important role.
We're talking to Anita Bean. Her new book is The Runner's Cookbook. Anita, let's get into some specifics. I think a lot of people, runners or not, are wondering, should I be eating carbs? Should I eat more carbs, fewer carbs? If I'm reading your book right, Anita, that's only part of the question. A big question, too, is which carbs should I be eating? Is that right?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. I mean, there are kind of two bits to your question. That is, first, you were talking about the amount of carbs, and the second is the type of carbs. Well, when it comes to the amount of carbs, you know, things have kind of changed over the years. There was a time when nutritionists like myself would be saying, yes, it's all high carb and low fat, but things have changed. There's a lot more research has been done over the last couple of years or so, and we now know that actually doing your high-intensity training, so say you're doing your tempo runs, your fast runs, your races, you will benefit by having your carbs, so that, you know, carbs basically will fuel fast running. But if you are doing, you know, long, easy runs, you know, the slow runs, the low-intensity runs, sometimes doing those running on empty, so on low carbs, then that will actually not only cause your body to burn a little bit more fat during your running, but it will also enhance the training adaptations that your muscles make after exercise. It will help to increase the number of mitochondria, for example. These are the powerhouses of your cells, so it's quite beneficial to have a lot of mitochondria if you're a runner. So what we now say to runners is fuel for your workout. You're doing a tough workout, you eat more carbs, you're doing long, steady, easy run, you can cut your carbs. Perhaps, you know, you will eat more protein, you will have eggs for breakfast, for example, not you know, cereals for breakfast. And then the other part of the question that you asked me, Rob, was about the type of carbs that you're eating. And you are absolutely right, this is so critical. Of course, you don't want to be fueling yourself all the time, you know, with white bread, with sugary drinks and sugary bars and energy bars. It's better that most of the time you're getting the healthy carbs. So we're talking about whole grains, we're talking about legumes like beans and lentils, garbanzo beans and peas. We're also talking about potatoes, sweet potatoes, rice, pasta, and all the different types of pasta you can get now made from different grains. So those kind of carbs should really be, you know, the main source of that. Oh, and bananas as well. Of course, we can't forget bananas. They are a real number one food for runners.
You mentioned that there are energy bars out there. A lot of them have a lot of sugar in them. And I want to get into one of the recipes you shared with us that we have up at WPR.org/Food Friday. We can make our own kind of power bar equivalents. So we've got a recipe from you for cocoa almond energy balls. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, sure. So sports nutrition products can work out quite expensive. And as you say, the ingredients are not necessarily that healthy. But you can make your own version. This is really what I promote. And it saves you money. You know exactly what's in there. The ingredients are healthy. You've got a little bit more fiber, but definitely more vitamins, minerals, all the right nutrients that you need to make you healthier and give you a lot more energy. So these cocoa and almond energy balls, which they're found in my book, of course, the great thing about these, they're basically they are made from date. Some people call them date balls. So they're made, the main ingredient is dates, but you would add an equal quantity of nuts. And the recipe that we were putting out on the website includes ground almonds. But instead of using almonds, you can substitute other nuts. You can put in cashew nuts or macadamia nuts, you know, whichever you prefer. In this recipe, I also add some oatmeal. I add a little bit of almond or peanut butter, the choice is yours. And there's also some cocoa powder, and that helps to create a more chocolate, you know, sort of chocolate tasting. But you, and then you've kind of got free range. Some people like to perhaps add a little bit of cinnamon, or you can add some vanilla. That's a favourite of mine. So you blitz the whole thing. You blitz those ingredients in a food processor. It will take perhaps 2 minutes. Depends how good your food processor actually is. And then you have a very stiff paste, a bit like patty, a bit like a very stiff dough. And you will then take small amounts of mixture, roll it in your hands to make bite-sized balls. And, you know, it's wonderfully therapeutic, because when you're doing that, it kind of feels like a game. It feels like you're a child again, and you're playing and doing something, you know, quite inventive and quite creative. And then what runners like to do, they like to coat. You then roll the balls to coat them in perhaps cocoa powder or some desiccated or shredded coconut, or maybe some chopped up pistachios. It makes them look great. They almost look like luxury chocolate truffles, but they are quite a lot healthier. But the great thing about these is that they're really portable and really handy, so it's really convenient to take perhaps on a long run. So if you're doing a run for an hour or longer, then instead of having your gels or energy bars, then you can take these with you. You just wrap them up in perhaps a little bit of, in the UK we call it cling film, I don't call it plastic film or foil, or you know, you kind of wrap them up, and then you can put that into your jersey pocket or a belt, take them with you, and then you've got sort of really good energy there, and it's good for you. It's definitely healthier than a lot of the gels that are out there.
We're talking to Anita Bean about her latest book, The Runner's Cookbook. She's a nutritionist and an athlete, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a runner, casual, or really serious about it? Do you have questions about what foods to eat before, after, maybe even during a run? Do you have a go-to thing that you might like to share and recommend? If you have a question about running and exercise and nutrition, give us a call. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Find a few of our guest recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Anita Bean is with us on Food Friday. She's a registered nutritionist, health writer, and the author of The Runner's Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about nutrition to fuel your running or other exercise? If you're a runner, casually or in a marathon sort of situation, what is your go-to as you get ready to run? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Want to check out another one of your recipes that you've shared with us, Anita, online at WPR.org/Food Friday, a chickpea and spinach curry. Can you tell us what you like about this one for runners in particular?
Yeah, okay, I like this recipe a lot. In fact, I just made it tonight here in the UK. It's the evening, actually. So I've had my evening meal. We call it dinner here. I don't know. Do you call it dinner or supper in the States?
I don't know that there's like a formal. We argue about which one is which, so either works.
Okay, so you're exactly the same as the UK, which is great. Okay, so I make this a lot. I probably make this curry about once a week, because the best thing about this curry is that it's quick, it's really simple, and as a runner, you don't want to be spending all your time in the kitchen. You want to be spending quite a lot of time running and recovering with your feet up. So simple, quick, but very healthy meals are what you really want. So here we go. It's chickpea and spinach curry. You can assemble it really from very simple ingredients, and if you've only got one vegetable in the house, you know, this is the thing to put it in. So the base of pretty much every curry is going to be an onion, some garlic. I always add in a little bit of ginger and a tiny bit of chili as well, actually. I don't like too much chili. But anyway, so the idea is that you fry your onion in a little bit of, we have a light olive oil, but you can use any other sort of not highly flavoured oil. So you fry your onion, you add garlic, some grated fresh ginger, maybe a little bit of chilli if you like your food hot. If you are a speedy cook, you can cheat by adding some curry paste. But if you've got, I like to be all sort of set up the spices, so I like to add the individual spices. That's the cumin, coriander, paprika, and garam masala. Those are my four main favourites. So it just depends how much time and effort you want to put into it. You've got options. And then you will always add in a tin of chopped tomatoes, so that's kind of a store cupboard ingredient. You will then add in a tin, or two tins actually, chickpeas, which are, I think you do call them garbanzo beans.
Either. We use both. They're labeled both ways here.
Okay, I didn't know that. I've learned something. Okay, but you can substitute, you know, if you don't have the chickpeas or garbanzos, you can add in any other kind of canned beans or lentils even, actually. So you add that, and then with this recipe, I've suggested that you add in some spinach, so it can be fresh spinach or it can be frozen spinach. So, you know, it can be as lazy. This meal can be as lazy as you like, but it's equally healthy. That's the important thing. There's no difference in the nutritional value. So tonight I added in a couple of big handfuls of fresh spinach that I happen to have in my fridge. But sometimes, you know, I've only got perhaps a cauliflower, so I'll put in cauliflower instead of spinach. Or if you've got perhaps some squash, you know, like butternut squash or something, you just put in that. So whatever vegetable you want to add, but, you know, whatever colours appeal to you, you just let that cook for literally 10 minutes. If you want, you can add in your salt, pepper, lemon juice, and then you've got a meal. But seriously, from start to finish, you can do this in 15 minutes. So I think that's a real win-win for a runner, quite honestly. And I serve it with rice. Sometimes I will add in, instead of rice, you can put in quinoa or some other kind of grains. Or you could add in a type of bread, maybe an Indian bread. So you've got your carbs, you've got your protein, you've got tons of fiber, you've got a lot of vitamins and minerals. You've got the iron, actually, from the spinach. You've got iron in the chickpeas. So you've got all the right nutrients that you need to aid your muscle recovery.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Doug is with us in Eau Claire. Doug, hi.
Hi there.
What'd you want to ask?
Anita, I'm a citizen bicycle racer. I hope you don't mind my crashing the runner's party here.
No,
but
no.
I think
exactly
most of what you do for runners applies to cyclists too.
And what did you want to ask, Doug?
My problem is every winter I gain weight, and every spring I'm desperately trying to lose it. At the same time, I'm trying to train up for the cycling race season. So, you know, it seems like I have a choice of losing weight or fueling for training, but it's hard to do both at the same time. What would you suggest?
Okay, so this is actually a really common dilemma that a lot of athletes have, actually. The key, ultimately, is trying not to gain too much weight, but I understand for your competitive season, when you're doing your races, you want to be pretty close to your racing weight, in other words, your optimal weight for racing, because, you know, when you're lighter, then you will become a faster cyclist or a faster runner. So the thing to do is obviously to try not to gain too much weight, and then to try to shed any excess weight at the very beginning of your competitive season, because it's very difficult to train hard whilst you're cutting your calories. But the way to cut calories, really, you've got to create a calorie deficit. So that essentially means you're burning more calories than you're consuming. There is no magic formula. There is no one-size-fits-all either. The secret, really, is to find an eating style that suits you as an individual. It doesn't need to be, you know, a diet plan that your mate follows or whatever is trending on social media. Essentially, you can cut calories from whether it's carbs or fat. It doesn't really matter, provided you're in calorie deficit. That's the main thing. You want to keep your protein about the same because you don't want to be losing muscle. You want to satisfy your hunger by consuming a lot of plant foods because they contain more fiber. So, you know, get your veg and your vegetables, your salads, the chickpea curry that I've just described to you, that's got chickpeas in, which is legumes. They're very filling. They're high in fiber. They are pretty low in calories per 100 grams. So it's trying to really make your meals as filling as possible so that they will satisfy your hunger so you're not feeling hungry all the time. Clearly, the best ways to cut calories is to look at your snacking habits and, you know, thinking, well, what can you swap out? Is there anything in there? Maybe if you are consuming sugary foods or snacks or something like that, or chips, then try to put in fruit and something a little bit healthier in place of those empty calories. So how does that sound to you? Does that sound like the kind of thing that you are already doing, or...
Well, those are the kind of things I think I should be doing and occasionally do. But, yeah, I think I got it. More fiber, more protein, cut down on the empty carbs.
Doug.
Absolutely.
Good luck to you, and I hope you get some biking weather here in Wisconsin. It's taking its time here in the state. Thanks so much for that call, Doug. I wanted to follow up, Anita. You mentioned there is a lot of advice out there online or from a friend or a running partner, and not all of it is necessarily legit. How do we assess whether this fad or health claim or miracle food is really what we need?
Okay, so there's so much confusing information on social media and websites, actually. Number one, I would obviously recommend looking in my own book because everything in there is evidence-based. Okay, so you've always got to look at the source of the information that you're reading. I mean, in my book, there were, it's not all sort of scientific and everything, but everything's evidence-based. But if you're reading something on a website or you're looking at something on social media, take a look at the source. Who's actually saying it? Are they citing a scientific study somewhere? Or is it just somebody's opinion? And the danger is when it's somebody's opinion and you don't want to take a lot of notice of that. If they're making some extravagant claims or promising a bit too much. And, you know, if they're using the word superfood, well, you should immediately become suspicious. There is no such thing really as a superfood. It's a marketing term because all foods can, you know, they will all supply you with nutritional benefits and health benefits. So you've really just got to look pretty carefully at the source of the information. You know, check out, has it come from a research paper or a university, and be quite skeptical and question the source.
We'll leave it there for now. Anita, thanks a lot for taking the time with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show. That's brilliant. Thank you.
We've been talking to Anita Bean. She's a registered nutritionist and health writer and a runner herself. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called The Runner's Cookbook, More Than 100 Delicious Recipes to Fuel Your Running. You can find three recipes that Anita shared with us. We talked with two of them for the little energy bar things, the chickpea and spinach curry. One we didn't get to, she says runners get to eat dessert too. We've got a baked raspberry cheesecake up there as well. It's probably a sometimes food for runners, I guess. You can find all three of those and more at WPR.org/Food Friday. Summer is sort of just around the corner, and you might already be thinking about finding a unique travel destination. Well, here's a luxury hotel for you, something I can just about guarantee you have not done before. There are a few downsides. It won't be open for business for another 4 years. The travel, it's a little rough. The price tag is $80,000 for the down payment toward the overall bill of $9.5 million per person. Where? In space. A Silicon Valley startup called Orion Span announced this week that they're planning a luxury hotel in low Earth orbit, with a grand opening aimed for, anyway, in 2022. That $9.5 million includes a 12-day stay, transportation to and from, that's key, and from orbit, plus participation in science experiments, astronaut training, and a whole bunch of sunrises and sunsets each and every day, because it's, you know, going around the Earth, the sun keeps coming up and going down for you. So if you've got that $9.5 million, you know, laying around, you didn't know what you were going to do with it, you don't mind, you don't have a problem with motion sickness. Okay, this all rules me out. But hey, let us know what it was like when you go there in 4 years. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.